Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the start of the Berlinale 2023 series of podcasts. I'm hunched in a typically ambitiously conceptual but brutalist architectural structure here in Potsdamer Platz, which is where the festival takes place. But I'm very pleased to be kicking off this series with the Berlin-based critic and also Fireflies Press co-publisher, Giovanni Marchini-Camia.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, we were just talking, is like the first, I guess, sort of full-fledged Berlinale edition. Last year was kind of subdued. It was in person, kind of subdued. And the year before was completely virtual. But I don't know, do you have any general notes to just kind of begin with on the festival?
Yeah, no, as I mentioned, it's kind of symbolic because I remember very clearly that on the first day of the Berlinale 2020 is when I started hearing voices that, you know, we might be in trouble with this virus that was making the news. And I remember dismissing it as paranoia. And then by the end of the festival, it was very clear that it wasn't paranoia. And then a week or so later, we were in lockdown. So being back does feel kind of, yeah, symbolic in that way of the maybe the pandemic being over or the worst of it. And I think the mood on the ground is really, it's great. People are so happy to be back and you can really feel the enthusiasm.
That's also despite it being a kind of gray series of days here. I mean, to start off with, just what's your entry into this edition? What's your kind of perspective?
I'm doing a couple reviews for Filmmaker Magazine and for Sight and Sound, but I'm also here because I'm also a programmer for the Locarno Film Festival. Mm-hmm. So I've actually, I'm doing both sides, the press side and the market side. So I probably won't be writing quite as much as I have in previous years. I still get to see 3-4 films a day, which is plenty.
Well, let's start off with one of those that's fresh for us, and I'd say is one of the more prominent films in the lineup, an Encounters title, The Adults, directed by a filmmaker that I've sort of happily followed since someone tipped me off to shorts he made, which were these really interesting, like, found footage that were really disturbing and really interesting. And those kind of came to my mind with this film. This is a film that really kind of creeps up on you. At least that's what happened for me. It's a movie about three siblings. Michael Cera plays a brother who has come to town to visit his two sisters. And one sister is, I guess, living in the family house that they grew up in. And she's played by Hannah Gross. Mm-hmm. And the other sister is, I guess, college age, but she has just left college. And that's kind of how it starts, with the semi-missed connections between them. And it just goes in sort of odd directions after that. But what did you think of where the movie went? Where did it take you?
Yeah, no, as you say, it's kind of unexpected. It's worth probably adding that Michael Cera doesn't live in the town where he flies. Do they say what the town is? I didn't recognize it.
I didn't either.
Because he flies in from Portland. So he at least flies. He's far enough from Portland to need to take the plane. But yeah, so he arrives and it has this quirky sort of vibe of the guy coming back to his hometown and trying to reconnect with friends, and it doesn't, the connections are a bit awkward. And it has, Michael Cera, which comes with its own sort of preconceptions. But then it turns into this exploration of the emotional scars, very deep emotional scars, it turns out, that the siblings have. The film stays very vague about what caused these emotional scars, but it seems like the siblings were very close growing up and they had a coping mechanism. They would assume voices, play theater, tap dance. They had all these routines that seems that they would kind of escape the reality with. And then as they grew up, they each grew apart, and there's real resentment for this growing apart. What's pretty funny is that he's meant to come for one night, and every day he kind of delays his flight one more night, and then he stays, I don't know, maybe a week or so. And over time, these scars come to the fore, and the siblings kind of come together in a way that is quite surprising and becomes quite emotional by the end as well.
Yeah, it is. And each of the performances were sort of differently surprising for me. I mean, Michael Cera usually has this semi-ironic quirkiness. In this case, it didn't really play that way for me. He's kind of more of just a sad sack. he's perpetually aggrieved that they don't laugh at the jokes he makes. Like the sisters make some riff on something and then his riff just falls flat. And felt like the movie got things like that, you know, like the kind of intra-family dynamics of the little like petty resentments, but also just the unspoken bonds you have and presumably the kind of shared suffering that's underneath it all. I thought he was very interesting. I thought Hannah Gross's character, you really feel her sense of aggrievement and simmering resentment toward her brother, which they stick with in this movie. Like you never really know whether that ice is going to thaw. And I think she really does really good work with that. And then, yeah, they have this routine. You mentioned they have these games and routines. And one thing they do is they have these like little characters they do.
That was the part of the movie that I had a bit of difficulty with. It seemed a bit too constructed. They would start doing these routines a bit too often for me. And, you know, they're at a party and all of a sudden they start speaking. Michael Cera's is this terrible British accent. And the others seem like characters from Adventureland. It worked the first time. And then it kept happening, and then they kind of build a climax out of it that was a bit, for me, it pulled me a bit away, and it seemed to construct these characters and overstate the emotional scar aspect. And I felt that at the very end, the final scene where they finally drop that and they have a face-to-face, a proper one, is much, much stronger. But maybe you needed that to precede it. Maybe that contrast was kind of important.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it functions is that they needed this indirect language of like engaging with each other, and the sort of climactic scenes in the movie are really incredible in that respect. I mean, just in that regard, like Michael Cera is a perfect actor for that. And also, just I forgot to mention the actress who plays Maggie, the college age sister, is Sophia Lillis, and she's also she has this tough kind of fulcrum kind of role where she has to be this cheerful mediating person a little bit between them, which is tough to do without seeming kind of have a hollow brightness. You know, I think there was a way that that could have been kind of disposable, but I think she actually really inhabits it in a nice way.
No, her performance is very delicate, and she's the only one of the three who is not resentful, but she's maybe the one that's got the biggest hurt. I had the feeling.
Yeah.
And I think her strongest moments are these silent moments where she looks at the two and you can see the panic that they're not going to manage to patch up these problems that they have.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful performance, all three of them, really.
Yeah. And, you know, a good use of location, too. They kind of, the family house that the Hannah Gross character lives in is just this, I don't know if you want to call it like a Victorian house, but it's just like this huge, sprawling, like way too big for a person to live in, which is feels exactly right for, you know, the family house that you've kind of ended up living in. So, yeah, and Michael Cera always wants the excuse to have to leave, you know, so he's always just immediately ready to escape. And also part of that is that he's like a poker player.
Well, I think he's a player generally because he's also like playing chess on his computer. I think it's just I think that's part of the familial trauma that he has to win all the time. And but it builds to these really great, it allows for these really great poker scenes, which are a lot of fun. And it starts off kind of quirky and then it becomes really dark, like this obsession of having to keep going.
Yeah, he seems to approach poker as a form of affirmation.
Which
is a weird way to approach poker. I don't know that that would be very satisfying in the long run. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty conscientiously shot film. Like the opening scene is a Sarah in a hotel room and it's clear that he creates this cocoon, you know, like he barely wants to leave it at the end. But at the same time, he's also kind of doing fairly common stuff. Like he sets up a little thing so he can play music and it looks like he's just going to be settling in there for the long haul. But this scene is, you know, has a resonance because it does feel like he needs to protect himself, you know. And it's funny that he has to gird himself just to like voyage back in time, which is more or less what coming back to his family seems to be for him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the adults. I'm really curious to see how people react to it. I haven't read anything about reactions to it, but it really got me at the end, I have to say. Well, let's talk about one movie that I think was a favorite for you, Orlando in the encounter section. So tell us about Orlando.
So Orlando is the first film by Paul B. Preciado, who is a Spanish but Paris-based writer, I believe. He's a trans man, and he's, I think, one of the most important theorists of transness. And this is his first film, and it's the full title is Orlando, I think, My Political Biography. And he starts off by saying in voiceover at the beginning that he wanted to do his biography, but he didn't need to because Virginia Woolf already wrote it for him, and it's Orlando, the book. The film is one of those kind of meta exercises with very artificial constructed sets, and you see the camera, you hear the director from behind it, and he invites a dozen or two dozen, a lot of different trans people to retell the story of Orlando, and in doing that, they make their own biographies in it. So there's these interesting passages where they read parts of the novel, but then you realize that they're actually talking about themselves or their partners or their experiences. So it creates this sort of polyphonic experience or a polyphonic expression of transness. Going in, I was worried that it might be a bit laden because of the theoretical background of the director, but actually it's really joyous and very playful and very engaging, and it strikes this very good balance between being didactic but not overbearingly so, and then gradually shifting towards being a sort of manifesto, and hugely affirmative and very welcoming. And no, it was like, yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
No, I mean, it was sort of remarkable to me because it sort of felt like a series of personal histories, just going into each person's experience and recent experience and hopes and dreams in a way. And then, yeah, overlaid and interwoven with Orlando. And I have to confess that in a way, at a certain point, I was like, it would have been okay if it was just about the 10 or 12 people, you know, and it didn't go into the Orlando text.
I'm not sure that I agree, because structurally, it really helps having this narrative. It gives the film a solid structure that otherwise might have been a bit too loose.
Okay.
And it's such a multi-layered film, and I appreciate having this extra layer, and also the way that the biographies are integrated in the text creates, it's not just a trans narrative, the Orlando text, but it transifies the text itself, which is interesting, which the film kind of then reflects on a formal level with all these meta exercises that it does. And and I also, I thought it was funny that it implicitly criticizes Sally Potter's Orlando by never mentioning it.
No, I see that. And I mean, one thing it does also is, I mean, besides delving into individual experiences, I mean, it also just, it does feel like Virginia Woolf was a time traveler, basically.
And maybe it was also, I don't know, a gesture of gratitude, because he starts by saying, I think he was 14 or 15 when he read it, and he hadn't really properly started coming to grips with his identity, and he read the book, and it was a hugely helpful revelation for him. So maybe it was, a kind of a gesture of gratitude, and then maybe it's also the film aspires to maybe fulfill that role as well, to pass it on.
Yeah, that's true. I also just want to mention there's a lot of voiceover. You hear a lot of the text, you know, being read in voiceover, so it is a very like texturally strong film. And also these kind of dramatizations of moments from the book while being aware of the artifice involved. You know, at one point someone is like reading, I think, passages, and the camera is wide enough that you see they're standing in a bucket, you know, presumably to tamp down the sound of their shoes. They go to a weapon shop at one point, which I thought was a pretty interesting passage of thinking about the kind of inherently exaggerated markers of masculinity. So there is a lot going on in the movie.
Yeah, it's really packed. No, it's super creative. And
a debut directorial feature as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that is Orlando. Shall we talk about a terrible movie?
Manodrome?
Gosh, this is very fresh for us. It's a fresh wound.
We literally just walked out.
Yeah. I mean, we finished it, but then we walked out. Where to begin? Actually, it is by the director of The Wound.
I haven't seen his previous stuff.
I think it was at Sundance a couple of years ago. So Manodrome, I mean, I don't even know how to describe what the story is in this movie because it's so ridiculous, really.
It's kind of like a update of Fight Club with incels, although they're voluntarily celibate.
Right.
So they're volcels, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, I guess it's kind of impressive to make a film that unpleasant. It's basically the whole thing is in the headspace of the main character, Jesse Eisenberg.
Mm-hmm. Ralphie.
Ralphie, yes.
In a clear reference to A Christmas Story. I mean, honestly,
there's a lot of Christmas aspects, yeah. And there's a tiny parallel to the adults in that he has serious hang-ups because of his way he was brought up by his father or abandoned by his father. But yeah, it's a tract on masculinity in contemporary society and the role of the fathers, and how badly they mess us up, and how one is pushed into these societies, be it incels or whatever. Do they have a name, this brother? Oh, yeah, Manodrome. Yeah.
I guess it's a Manodrome. They get a little tattoo that kind of looks like it's somewhere between like an anarchy and a Masonic symbol. I don't know.
With Adrian Brody as the ringleader called Dad Dan. Yeah, the older men are called Dad, the younger men are all called Son, and it's this makeshift family where I don't know what they do. They live together and they hate women together or something like that. Yeah,
in this mysterious like manor house that they just have.
Yeah, because Adrian Brody is super rich and he's happy to pay for all his children to live in bunk beds.
Yeah,
there and yeah, it's basically like a frat house.
That's right. Yeah, it is like a frat house. Yeah. So there's that strand. I mean, Ralphie has a wife played by Odessa Young who is pregnant. And I guess they have some tensions in their marriage because she feels like she can't rely on them. But they have this old bond. But maybe it's fraying. And he's an Uber driver. And I guess
he was laid off. And that's like a big problem why he's so insecure.
Yeah, but then like also in the movie, it's like a gay panic thriller in a way because he's constantly basically menaced by the presence of other men. You know, he goes to the gym and he just can't handle it. And wherever you think that goes in terms of the movie, you're right. And it's just, I can't, you know, you just watch one of these movies. We were talking how like there always seems to be like some sort of shooter movie or something like that. That's trying to make some sort of pronouncement. And I say it's trying to make a pronouncement because the actual character is so not credible as like a person, really.
No.
You know, and I have to say, like, Jesse Eisenberg is not the person who's going to put across, you know, a character like this. Like,
I mean, he buffed up.
He did bulk up, yeah. I mean, he is a very distinctive star presence in movies, I have to say, but is he a good actor?
I mean, like, he always has the same facial expression.
Wince.
He always has the same nervous, jittery energy, which here is his anger at society and not being respected.
Yeah.
But no, he's not believable. But the film also doesn't allow him to be believable. True. There's nothing there except he's working class, he's lost his job, and his dad was an asshole, and therefore he has to explode into violence at the end and do some really horrible things.
Yeah, and I just feel like a movie like this kind of betrays its simplicity by thinking it has to come up with some scheme. You know, like, it has to come up with this schematic thing of like, oh, there is this men's club that's like, you know, I mean, in the 90s, they used to have like these Iron John clubs or something, like these, you know, men getting their self-respect back, like the kind of precursor to like Jordan Peterson or something like that now. But yeah, it doesn't even make sense, you know, and I kept thinking like, I wish he had just done a movie about QAnon or something, because like that's something I'd actually would like to see someone try to like figure out, because he in a way like simplifies things and then in doing so doesn't really explain anything or put across anything.
Yeah, and just it's just a repetition of other films doing the same thing.
Yeah,
and
or Falling Down is another movie a little bit.
Sure, yeah. Falling Down, Fight Club. I don't know. We have so many of these, insecure masculinity erupting into violence. And I don't know that we need them. And it's such an relentlessly unpleasant viewing experience the whole time.
It is very grating. I actually wrote down the word grating at a certain point. Everything about it is pretty grating. And also, he doesn't even have the courage of his convictions. Like there are a couple of times where like something violent happens and they don't even commit to whether it's happening or not, you know, like it feels like a fantasy. I feel like if you can't even do that, so yeah, I mean, when you get to a point where the suspense is whether a guy's going to shoot himself, it's like, I don't, you know, anyway, I don't want to sound insensitive, but within the confines of this film, it's not, but I have to say it was a totally packed screening.
Yeah, but that's always the case at the Berlinale with the American screenings that have stars, I feel like, in competition. Uh-huh. People expect something good.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, it's Saturday, so it's the weekend. It has a prime spot.
Yeah. I mean, I have to think, this is a title that needs to be sold as well. I guess it probably is a sales title.
No idea about that dimension, but yeah, it's one of the hot ticket titles because, you know, they also have to get Jesse Eisenberg on the red carpet, so...
It's still sort of like semi-bizarro world that he's a star to me. Like, you know, I just think of him like, you know, bopping around and Squid and the Whale is like the awkward older brother. That's what he still is to me. Somehow doing the same 3-point neck movements that he does, you know, where he's like doing this thing. Anyway, I don't want to pile on Manodrome, but also it's called Manodrome. I mean, it's just...
it's not promising.
It's not very promising, but somehow I felt like I had to see it. So, yeah. Maybe we can just quickly talk about... There was a lovely film by Luke Fowler about Margaret Tate. So I feel like I would remiss if I just sat here and rambled about Manodrome and didn't mention something like... full title is Being in a Place, A Portrait of Margaret Tate, directed by Luke Fowler. And it's about the Scots... filmmaker Margaret Tate. I just thought this was a totally beautiful film. It's a sort of becalmed portrait by means of her voice, like the audio interview and voiceover, which is so personal. It feels like it's just her reflections. Mm-hmm. And then, like, they're not excerpts from her films, I guess.
I think there's some excerpts from her films.
At the Q&A, the one I went to had a Q&A with Fowler afterwards, and he was at pains to describe afterwards that I guess Margaret Tate didn't like clips of her films to be used because she felt like it would stop people from watching her films, which I understand. So he used, I don't know if outtakes is the right word, but various like rushes or outtakes sort of. So it looks like they're from them, but it's not the final product. So he does that and he kind of revisits locations and people.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just, I don't know. This is also a movie that you liked, right?
Yeah, no, it's very delicate and very, you know, it's a heartfelt homage to this filmmaker that it clearly means a lot to him.
Yeah.
It's also got a bit of humor. Like, I thought it was, I mean, it's, I don't know if people are familiar with Luke Fowler's aesthetic, but it's that 16mm DIY aesthetic. And maybe it was just my humor, but I thought it was funny that there isn't a single shot of sunshine. Like, it's this the Scottish Highlands couldn't be photographed more less appealingly, but it has a charm all its own. And also aspects like it, I thought it was nice the way because you see a lot of the materials, her working materials, the stuff, the treatments or the applications she would write for funding, or her notes, her personal notes. He photographs her diary, and the kind of emphasis on how expensive it is to be an independent filmmaker of that kind, and all that was really quite fascinating and very, very personal.
Yeah, I mean, it really gets inside her experience as a, you know, working filmmaker. You know, they has this like exchange of letters with which they hold on the screen long enough for you to really glean what's going on with the BBC, which is kind of notoriously institutional wall, basically, of her, you know, really putting together like a package for them and saying, this is what I'd like to do. I think it's important. And they're just like, oh, it's just not the sort of work we do. I almost slipped into the voice that Michael Cera does in The Adults. But it's just great that she just kept, there's just such a pure like love there. At one point, she just like is listing the filmmakers that she likes. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? And she pauses and says, can't really think of any British filmmakers. so yeah, there's that problem. Humor there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, altogether pleasing. Only about 60 minutes, I want to say.
Yeah, and I don't know if you mentioned it, it's a forum film, since we've now discussed Encounters, Competition, Forum.
Yes.
Competition is pretty clear. That's the big competition with the bigger titles. Yeah. Forum is the independent section that, since the 70s, I think, I'm not exactly sure, but it was always the more experimental section. It's also where you find a lot more documentary or hybrid films. And Encounters is a new section that was introduced with the current artistic director Carlo Chatrian, which is a bit more difficult to define because it does a lot of the things that Forum used to do, but maybe on a on a bigger scale, the budgets are bigger, they're more polished films, but also in the more experimental side of things.
Yeah, there are often a lot of finds to be had there. I don't know, one of my most vivid ones last year was Unrest.
Mm-hmm. For me, that was the film of the festival last year. No, the Encounters has been really great. Last year was, the competition was very disappointing, I found. Mm-hmm. And whereas Encounters, I think I found, I don't know, maybe 6, 7, or even 8 films that were really strong.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the shadow competition or something. Mm-hmm. It's like the shadow.
I mean, it is a competition. They do have prizes. Yeah. And yeah, I think that's how they managed to draw a lot of big, like they always have big names in there. I mean, the inaugural film of the section was Christy Puyu in the first
right.
year.
Yeah.
Mount Grog.
Yeah, that was intense. So there's plenty still yet to see from all these sections, but we can probably bring things to a close there. Do you know what the next film you're going to be going to?
I'll be going to see, it's an Encounters film, Here, by Bas Devos, yes. The mm-hmm. Belgian filmmaker, and the people who have already seen it speak very well of it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I'll be seeing you around and about.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.